Hello and welcome to the End of Life University Seminar Series. This is your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and today I'm happy to welcome my guest, Dr. Stanley A. Terman. Dr. Terman is a psychiatrist and the CEO and medical director of Caring Advocates. He holds a bachelor's degree from Brown University, a PhD from MIT, and an MD degree from the University of Iowa. Before he founded the nonprofit organization Caring Advocates in the year 2000, Dr. Terman served on the faculty of University of California, Irvine. The continuous thread of Dr. Terman's professional career is to empower people to make informed decisions so they can successfully meet challenges in their lives with more pleasure, less suffering, and improved relationships. For almost two decades, he has specialized in reducing the suffering of terminally ill patients and their loved ones, especially those faced with unending, unbearable pain or the many challenges of advanced dementia. Dr. Terman authored four books that deal with end-of-life choices: The Best Way to Say Goodbye, Peaceful Transitions, Stories of Success and Compassion, and Peaceful Transitions, Plan Now, Die Later, Ironclad Strategy, as well as the novel Lethal Choice. He created an advanced care planning tool, My Way Cards, Natural Dying Living Will Cards, that generates a clear and specific living will to overcome the challenges of advanced dementia, as well as other terminal illnesses. The natural dying living will informs others when to stop interventions that only delay dying, increase suffering, and prolong burdens. Dr. Terman's professional articles have appeared in The Lancet, American Journal of Bioethics, Palliative Medicine, Caring for the Ages, Behavioral Sciences, and the Law. His most recent article, published in the Hamlin Law Review, is It Isn't Easy Being Pink, Potential Problems with Post-Paradigm Forms, and it's currently listed among the most frequently downloaded articles in the Elder Law Studies e-journal. Dr. Terman, I'm so happy that you've joined us here today, and welcome.
And thank you for sharing all the details in the introduction. That was one of the best, and I think that it's so important to have at end-of-life university. There's so much that needs to be understood so that we can approach the last chapter of our life to maximize our pleasure and the meaningfulness of the experience, and to minimize our pain, our suffering, and our conflicts.
And I absolutely agree with you, Dr. Terman, and it's so clear that you've really devoted your career to that goal. But I was wondering if you could just share with all of our listeners briefly how you yourself became interested in working with end-of-life issues, because I know you're a psychiatrist by training, and so I was just curious about that part of your story.
I would be delighted. I'm one of those psychiatrists who really enjoys talking to patients and to fixing psychosocial problems, improving relationships, for example. And so I've done a lot of work with families, with couples, intergenerational, and I've focused on brief, strategic psychotherapy. Medications when needed, but sometimes, but my real forte was to do psychotherapy. So one of my families turned out was had a problem one day. In the morning, Ronald Ferris called me and he said, "I just coughed up blood. And I'm going to the doctor. I'll call you later." That afternoon, he said, "I have a diagnosis and it's horrible, lung cancer." And that was in the late 1990s. And unfortunately, he died 10 months later. He improved his relationship over that period of 10 months with my privilege to try to help him with his wife, with his three daughters, one of whom had previously been estranged, coping with the prospect of leaving this world, making all his relationships and his other businesses as peaceful and as settled as he possibly could. And I remember driving to the airport, and he called me and he said, "Stanley, I can't tell you, we just couldn't have done this without you. This is your calling." Those words buzz in my ear to this day. And I said, gee, I guess you're right. And at that time, I was writing the novel Lethal Choice about, it's kind of a, it, Lethal Choice is a medical, legal, psychological thriller. And I said, I better learn something about this field in general in a greater depth. So I took myself over to the San Diego Hospice, which was one of the premier organizations. And there I trained for a couple of years informally. I didn't take a fellowship. I was already quite advanced in my career, but I got some wonderful mentoring. And then I, a few years later, I said, you know, there's one problem at end of life that no one has solved. And that's the problem of advanced dementia. It is the most cruel, most prolonged, and most burdensome of any stage of any disease. It is so challenging because so often there is no plug to pull. Karen, I'm sure you know this, and perhaps your other shows have indicated that when a patient is on the medical intensive care unit of a hospital, the chances are about 7 out of 10 that they will die after the doctor and the surrogate decision makers, which could be officially appointed proxy agents or just the loved ones, agree the time has come. And then they withdraw the life-sustaining treatment. That's usually a high-tech kind of apparatus. Could be a ventilator, a breathing machine. It could be just medications that sustain blood pressure or whatever. But that's when the patient dies. In the case of a patient who reaches the stage of advanced dementia, a prolonged dying with a life that is really loathsome to them and others, that has lost its dignity, could go on literally for years, as long as someone, another person's hand, continues to put food and fluid into the patient's mouth. Patients will have lost the knowledge, the brain function to understand what food and fluid is. How to use a spoon, how to use a straw. They will not be able to pick up a glass, not because of any physical handicap, but because they don't understand how to do it anymore. But they can continue to exist as long as someone feeds them. So the question is, what if we stop? What if we let dying occur naturally as it would if we weren't providing this at now extraordinary and disproportionate kind of care by spending literally hours a day trying to give them enough nutrients so that they can survive? And the first patient that I describe in my book Peaceful Transitions lost weight from 180 to 70 pounds over a period of 2 years, because even despite the best of efforts, such efforts are futile. They're non-beneficial. They don't work. And basically, this poor fellow, whose son gave me permission to use his name and his father's name, died of slow starvation. Nobody wants that. Problem of the challenge of advanced dementia and how to avoid a prolonged dying was one of the most important unsolved problems in the end-of-life universe, and I have been devoting the last 15 years to honing down an ironclad strategy, the means for people to say, okay, if I do this, then I can be sure that I won't have this most cruel, most burdensome, and most prolonged way of prolonging my dying.
And would you talk a little bit more about that term you use, the ironclad strategy?
Let me start off by saying that many people underestimate just how difficult it is to get your wishes fulfilled when you reach the point where you no longer can talk for yourself, no longer can make medical decisions, have lost mental capacity, are no longer competent. I use all those terms. They all mean approximately the same thing. As long as you can speak for yourself, you can say, this is what I want, this is what I don't want. And every adult in the United States who has competence can refuse any medical treatment for any reason, and they don't even have to justify it. And this came down, as you know, as a ruling in the 1990 case of Nancy Cruzan, heard by the Supreme Court of the United States. And I would only add one thing, that is that that patient should be fully informed, have all the reasonable knowledge to know what the options are, so that any competent adult who is informed can refuse any treatment, even if that treatment is likely to lead to an earlier dying. If you cannot speak for yourself, and the chances are 7 out of 10 people who are listening to your show today will get to the point where they get very ill, will not be able to speak for themselves, will not have mental capacity. The physicians need to have another way to learn what are your end-of-life wishes. And generally speaking, there are two ways. One is you can write them down in what's called a living will. A living will is a set of instructions to physicians, and they follow the general pattern of, or format, if, then. If I'm in a coma and there's no possibility that I can recover, then this is what I want. Stop all life-sustaining treatment, for example. Okay. So that's one way. You write it down. The second way is that you appoint people whom you trust to make decisions for you. Okay. Both of those ways, and I've been in the trenches now for so many years, and I see it over and over again, are plagued with challenges that people don't appreciate. I meet people who say, oh, I have a living will. And I say, yes, but does it cover advanced dementia? And 9 out of 10 of them do not. Mm-hmm. Or if people say, my spouse, he knows what I want. I don't have to worry. And yet what happens if that spouse is not available when the time comes? What if they become incapacitated mentally? Or what if they're not alive when you need that help? Will the second in command know as much as the first whom you appoint? And then this, and I cannot impress enough why it's important to have three components to your advanced care planning. A living will that is really clear and really specific, that really covers advanced dementia. That's part one. Part two is not just one, but several people whom you trust who know what your wishes are and are willing to go fight for them, to advocate for you. And then the ironclad strategy. And 2 out of 3, most of the time will work, but sometimes it won't. I'll give you an example of a very sad case that was just decided on February 3rd, 2014, by the Supreme Court of the province British Columbia, just north of us. Margaret Bentley had been a nurse and had taken care of patients who had advanced dementia, so she really knew that this was not a stage of the disease that she wanted to have or to endure a prolonged dying. So she created and completed a living will, and she appointed her husband and her daughter to be her proxy agents. The Supreme Court ruled that even though it takes up to 6 times to put a spoon on her lips or a glass on her lips to evoke the reflex of opening her mouth and then swallowing, which, by the way, she'll do even if the spoon is empty, which kind of proves that it's a reflex, even though it can take up to 6 times to get her to eat and drink, not eat it, by feeding and by putting in liquid by another person's hand, by reflex, this must continue until she dies of another cause. And she had a living will, and she had a proxy, and she had an agent. But she did not have an ironclad strategy. Also, there were problems with her living will, as there are problems with so many living wills that my colleagues and I in Caring Advocates review free of charge And we say, yes, this will do the job, or it should be tweaked. And by the way, it is possible, Dr. Wyatt, to have two living wills, and one is very general. For example, five wishes is a very nice living will, because the last few of those five wishes, you can say, this is the pictures that I want to have, this is the music that I want to have played, this is the kind of flowers that I want to have, and all this nice, sweet stuff is great, as long as there's no conflict and you're not having a prolonged dying with suffering and burdens. So how can you have two living wills? You can just say in one of them, if there's a conflict between the two, this is the one that prevails. It's just that simple. Okay, so Margaret Bentley had a living will, and it didn't work. And it was disqualified by the British Columbia Supreme Court. What she said was, I want no nourishment or liquids. But she also had another statement that said that she did not want to be kept alive by artificial means. The judges put together those two sentences and they said, well, she probably means tube feeding, not hand feeding. I would disagree, and I think 9 out of 10, if not 99 out of 100 people would disagree, because there was another statement in her living will that says, it points out a specific symptom that's very well known that occurs in middle to advanced dementia. It says, and I quote from Margaret Bentley's living will, in the event that mental deterioration is such that I am unable to recognize the members of my family, I ask that I be euthanized. And euthanasia means that someone, a physician, puts into your body lethal medication that causes your death immediately. And this would be voluntary euthanasia because she asked for it. Mm-hmm. What's the problem with that? The problem is that that is an illegal request. It was not legal for her to ask other people to commit a crime. And so the nursing home that saw this living will became alarmed. And they said, this living will is not valid because of that one statement that's illegal. What could have Margaret Bentley done? She could have said, just added the words. I counted them, 13 words. Instead of saying no nourishment or liquids, she could have added the four-letter word, no oral nourishment or liquids. Or two words, no nourishment or liquids, even by mouth. Done deal. And then she could have said, I ask that I be euthanized if, when I get to that stage, it is legal. Then it would have been very clear that this woman does not want to live in the stage of advanced dementia, but she's not asking for anything that is illegal, and therefore the most important thing that we can do to honor and to respect a person who is suffering unbearably is to fulfill their end-of-life wishes. These are the last wishes that they beg us to honor, and we should do that every time we possibly can. So she had a living will that was flawed because the wording was not quite right. And one other problem that Margaret Bentley had was that she created her living will in 1991, and the British Columbia legislators passed other laws later on so that when she mentioned something like basic care, that she wants to receive basic care because she doesn't want to suffer. She, even if it would inadvertently hasten her dying, she still wants basic care. Well, they took those two words, basic care, and they say that now, post facto, they're in the statute, and it's not legal to ask to forego basic care. Well, it's legal and it's respectful to honor a person's wishes and her intent, but inadvertently, Margaret used words that became buzzwords, and so she is now suffering. She already has had 3 years where she has not been able to utter a word, a coherent sentence. And who knows how much longer she is now going to have to live in this state, which she tried very, very hard to avoid.
So it sounds like your organization might have been able to help her avoid these issues just by reviewing the living will and pointing out some of the problems with it for her. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. Of course, when Margaret was had capacity, when she was competent, when she created her living will in 1991, we didn't have the ironclad strategy. This strategy has been available since 2009 and further revised and refined in 2011. And now it's set. So it would have been too, but we could have done some other things. And in fact, I've been in contact with the physician who's taking care of her near Vancouver. And we're still seeing if anything we can do. But yes, for your listening audience, if they are interested in having a free opinion as to whether their living will is likely to do the job or needs to be slightly tweaked or maybe add another one to it, we would be delighted to do it, okay, to provide that free advice. So you need a living will because you have to have a statement that says very clearly what you precisely want. Stopping eating and drinking is against our food-loving culture. And it sounds like Holocaust, surviving, starving. It sounds like cruel. But in fact, advanced cancer patients who have not lost the ability to speak for themselves tell us that eating is a burden. Eating takes the energy and makes them more uncomfortable. And many of them voluntarily give up eating and drinking, even though they could still eat and drink. And in fact, Linda Ganzini, a medical doctor in Oregon, did a study in 2003 that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and she showed that dying by refusing food and fluid is more peaceful than dying by physician-assisted dying. A very surprising result. And actually, even though I knew about this result, I still had to do some things for myself, Karen, Dr. Wyatt, to prove it to myself. Because I said, how can I recommend this to people unless I really know? So I underwent 2 complete fasts of food and fluid myself. One lasted for 4 days. The other lasted for 5 days. The 5 days through YouTube / Dr. Terman. So anyway, if you want to see what a person looks like after they've been fasting for 5 days, not that bad. Although what I found was that hunger is not a problem, and that's what the literature said. Hunger is not a problem because you change your metabolism, you produce ketones, and this process called ketosis provides a mild euphoria that reduces hunger. However, thirst was a problem, but it's a problem that can be solved. It can be solved by using thirst-reducing aids. And so members of Caring Advocates have access to us sending out them a TRAK, a thirst-reducing aid kit that it contains all the things that you may need, sprays and gels and swabs and drops and so forth, to maintain your comfort throughout the usually 7 to 14 days from the time you stop eating and drinking completely to you have a peaceful diet. And I've been at the bedside of dozens of patients and heard about many, many more. And this is, it turns out to be, one of the most comfortable ways to die. 2 of my colleagues who have been co-authors on the book, both of their mothers died this way. My stepfather died this way. My father-in-law died this way. There are other peaceful ways to die. Hepatic coma, renal coma, not for sure, but maybe insulin coma. Natural dying is one of the most peaceful ways to die.
And I wanted to mention, my own mother died last year. She had biliary cancer, and for the last month of her life, she didn't eat at all. She felt terrible every time she ate. She had terrible pain and bloating and distension. And it was extremely peaceful and very comfortable for her. She did drink a little bit during that month, but she stopped eating. She lost weight. She was definitely wasting away by the end of the month. But she was able to devote all of her energy, as you were describing, to working through other issues at the end of life. She had no interest in eating. Food wasn't important to her anymore.
Excellent.
And it was very beautiful.
Very beautiful is a wonderful way to describe the very last part of the last chapter of one's life. And I'm glad that your mother had that. By the way, the more you drink, the longer the process will take. And so we don't usually recommend ice chips. And we can take care of thirst in other ways. But the advantages of dying by voluntary refusal of food and fluid, dying in the way that we call natural dying, is that if you're alert, you actually become more alert because you are not plagued by all the, for example, if you have cancer, the bloatingness and the pressure of the cancer on other organs. Or if you have a brain problem, one of the ways people become more alert is to take fluid off the brain. So that Joanne Lynn in 1986 published a landmark book that proved in so many ways physiologically why it's so much more peaceful to die by refusing food and fluid. So what people don't realize about patients who are in the advanced stage of dementia is very significant. I've heard authorities in the field, and I won't name them, but say advanced dementia patients don't suffer. They just don't know what's going on. That is not true. Patients in the permanent or persistent vegetative state may not be able to experience pain and suffering, but patients in the stage of advanced dementia can and do experience pain and suffering. And that's why it's so important not to prolong the process of dying. I have in my book listed many studies that show, and I'll just give you a couple of examples. If you break a hip and you're demented, you will probably get one-third as much medication as if you break a hip and you can still ask for medication when you want it. And so, unfortunately, patients who are in the stage of advanced dementia no longer can complain. They no longer can say, "Doctor, it hurts here, and it still hurts even though you gave me some medication." They're just at our mercy to hope that we give them enough pain medication instead of under-treating their pain. In addition, there's another unique problem that patients in advanced dementia have, and that is their response to pain is atypical. It's not like patients who do not have dementia who are in pain. Patients who can express themselves, say, "Gosh, this is awful. I have this very unpleasant experience. Please help me," and so forth. What do patients who have dementia do? They sometimes become violent. If they become violent, they get sedated with tranquilizers that rarely touch the pain. If they become withdrawn, which is another very typical way that patients respond to pain in advanced dementia, then they're no problem to the staff, so they ignore them. They're just sitting there. There are anecdotes as well, and although that's not scientific proof, we have to take this to our heart. And there was a program called the Awakenings in Minnesota, where someone innovatively wanted to see what would happen in a nursing home if they slowly and carefully took patients off as many medications as possible and see whether they did better, whether they became more functional and social and so forth. Well, one of the patients who said, "Oh, yeah, she was always moaning and groaning, always saying, help me, help me, help me, help me. You know, that's just who she is. It's a constant with her. We don't have to pay attention to that." When they took her off all the medications that were also impacting on her mental abilities, she was finally able to point to her knees. And when they did an ultrasound and x-rays, they found that there was no cartilage left. There are so many kinds of pain that you cannot see. Yeah, you can see a bed sore. It looks horrible. Raw and red and bleeding and ulcerated and so forth. But sometimes arthritis and bowel obstructions and there are many kinds of pain that you can't see. And so here's my point. When you're doing advanced care planning, when you're creating your living will, and when you are deciding, making your best guess of what to instruct people in the future, if you reach the stage of advanced dementia, it is possible. And in fact, one of my co-authors in my most recent paper that's coming out soon argues this point, and we fully respect it. Maybe those spoonfuls of pureed food that are just the right consistency so you don't choke on them are still sweet nectar to you, and you still enjoy them, and you still therefore find this to be a reason to stay alive. Yeah, that's one possibility. But the other possibility is that, particularly as the number of dementia patients triples, as the number of caregivers goes down, as the people leave the field of geriatrics because it's so challenging and underpaid compared to doing more remunerative kinds of medicine and nursing, that you will be warehoused in a place where your health care providers will not recognize that you have pain. And if they don't recognize that you have pain, they will not treat your pain, and you may be suffering for years. There's your choice. Which one do you want? I know what I choose for myself. When I meet the certain criteria that are that my living will can set forth in terms of these are the ones that are really important to me, then I want natural dying. I no longer want to be treat and fed.
Would Dr. Terman, would you tell us about some of the resources? I know you've spent a lot of time creating information products for the lay public, for caregivers and for patients. And would you tell us a little bit, I know, about some of your books and your the Living Will cards?
Sure, I'll be glad to. There are people who are not informed who say, as if it's a fact, you just can't imagine what your existence will be like in advanced dementia. Therefore, don't even try. I so disagree with that, because if you really want to know what advanced dementia is like, just go to a skilled nursing home, and about 2 out of 3, if not 7 out of 8 patients there will be suffering from dementia, and you can see firsthand and smell firsthand. But you could also see videos, and we've created videos. And then one of the resources that I can point out to you is a 6-minute video. There's a video entitled Alzheimer's Disease, Facing the Facts, Public Broadcasting Service, 2008, won an Emmy in 2009. It's an hour long. But I condensed it to 6 minutes, and those 6 minutes introduce you to about a dozen patients who are suffering from different kinds of symptoms from advanced dementia, and that is one of the best introductions. My colleagues and I also created the Natural Dying Living Will cards, which has another name as well called My Way cards, and they're the same tool to create a living will, except that one honors the religious perspective to try to be consistent with the major conservative religions. And the other, that's the Natural Dying Living Will cards. The My Way cards, as you can tell from the title, champions, is for those who champion autonomy, the right of self-determination. It's my body and I want to decide what happens to it, so do it my way. So, but the cards themselves, number 48, and each one is written in very simple, plain language, accompanied by an illustration. And for each card, you make a decision one at a time. If I'm in this condition, for instance, we have a patient who's hiding under a pillow and is just scared to death of hallucinations and the two people on either side of the bed that cannot possibly console them. Okay, hallucinations are particularly common in the dementia that is associated with Parkinson's disease or Lewy body disease. And that's another kind of suffering. So you say, okay, if I were in this situation, I now have three choices. Choice number one is treat and feed. Do everything you possibly can so that I can live as long as possible. The next is I choose the option of natural dying. So I don't want any food or fluid by another person's hand to put it into my mouth, but I still want all the comfort care that I need so that I can die peacefully. The third is consider natural dying. Let my proxy decide. I can't decide for this particular issue when. Maybe I only have some hallucinations like this, for example, once every 2 weeks, and they only last for 10 minutes. And at other times, I'm not too bad. I kind of enjoy life a little bit. You can see me smile a little bit. In that case, even you may have the symptom, but it's not severe enough for natural dying. And so the best person to decide is your proxy when that time comes. And so these are the three choices. There may be other symptoms, unwanted behaviors, loss of functioning, or conflicts with long-term values, lifelong values, in fact, that you would say, absolutely, I want natural dying every time. For example, if you have to tie me down or give me chemical restraints so I don't lash out at people who love me because I don't know who they are anymore, because I can't tell the difference between what is gentle touching and physical assault, and I live in this horrible state where I fear being touched and I react so horribly, that alone might be natural dying, absolutely. So it's a unique living will. Very few living wills, but some offer the global instruction to those who will be interpreting them in the future, whether they have leeway or no leeway. In other words, is this strict? We follow it exactly to the letter, or we massage it and see and consider it in the context of what else is going on at that time. For the natural dying living will and my way cards, you can indicate whether you want 100% leeway or zero leeway for each of these 48 symptoms.
Are these cards available on the website, the Caring Advocates website?
Indeed they are. And in fact, there's a free demonstration. As I mentioned, there are 48 cards total. You can see the first 27 with no obligation as an absolutely free demonstration. It's called Learn Before You Decide. And that has a double meaning. Learn Before You Decide means globally, if I'm going to be challenged by the stage of advanced dementia, I need to learn about this, what it is like for me as a patient and for my loved ones who have to take care of me and make sacrifices for me. So I have to learn. So I want to learn before I decide how to create my living will. And the other minor reason is we have this tool, and if you want to learn before you decide whether you want to buy it or not, then you can, and it, the cost is modest, then you can take the 27 out of 48 and see whether it suits you or not. So it's Learn Before You Decide. It's on the caringadvocates.org.
And then it sounds like your book would also be a great resource because they contain stories. So that might be something someone wanting to learn more about natural dying could read these actual patient stories in your books.
Exactly. Peaceful Transitions, Stories of Compassion and Success, it motivates people, shows you the good and the bad, and what happens if you don't have an ironclad strategy, and what can happen peacefully, and as you use your word for your mother, beautifully, if you do. The second book, and by the way, they're also available on Amazon Kindle as an ebook, Peaceful Transitions, Ironclad Strategy, that tells you exactly what you have to do. Now, I want to point out about that book is that it's great for those people who really want to delve in and do it yourself. And because we want to make sure that people can have confidence in it, we've covered all the bases, all the ones that we know about and can anticipate. But sometimes people need a little guidance, and that's why Caring Advocates is here. So you can either buy that book, Plan Now, Die Later, or you can say, okay, to one of our staff people, how can, you know, hold my hand, take me through it, what do I have to sign, and explain it to me, and then so we can make it a little easier. And just to give you an example of what the Ironclad strategy is, in addition, have a Skype video interview that we record with patients who want the program so that they can have full confidence in it. And on this video, with a set of structured questions, we ask the advanced care planner, the person who's doing the living will and designating the proxies, we ask the advanced care planner, what precisely do you want and why do you want it on video? And then when the video has gets to the end, then the clinician, it could be me if you like, puts a good housekeeping seal of approval. In other words, we say, for making these end-of-life medical treatment decisions, you have capacity. You are competent. That video is so golden. Anyone who sees the video will say, well, that's it. There's no conflict. This is what she wants. This is why she wants it. It was approved by a psychiatrist, and there's a slam dunk. No conflicts. There's only one problem with having such an effective ironclad strategy, Karen, and it's you may not guess it, so let me tell you what it is. If it's too good, it works. So that dying occurs not only peacefully and timely, but also privately. And when it occurs privately, you don't read about it in the newspapers, and you don't find out about Caring Advocates. So the better we are, the better the ironclad strategy is, the less we have the notoriety or news to let people know that this will work. It's ironic.
That's true. The fewer controversial cases there will be that get covered in the news, and therefore we won't be hearing about this, but all the better reason for us to do this interview and try to get the word out to people about Caring Advocates.
It is so important. I can't think of a disease that is worthy of more effort and time and energy to plan ahead for than advanced dementia. One of my financially oriented colleagues suggested this. He said, think about return on investment. 1 to 3 hours of advanced care planning could save you 1 to 3 years of living in a state of that you now would consider to be misery, and could wipe out your assets so that your grandchildren can't go to college. So yeah, that's a return on investment.
That's just a great point. And I was wondering if you had any suggestions to share, you know, if someone's listening right now who themselves feels like this is what I would like to have in my living will, how they might approach family members to have a discussion about natural dying.
Excellent point. We have a list of questions that begin with, is this a good time to discuss a rather sensitive issue? It was published originally in my first book, The Best Way to Say Goodbye, A Legal Peaceful Choice at the End of Life. And we are doing a survey because now that I've created with my colleagues the Ironclad strategy, and I can come out of my writing research, actually cave, in which I just hide from the world so I can get this work done, I want to encourage everybody to have effective living wills. And by effective, I mean that when your future doctor sees it, he puts his pen or her pen to the paper and writes the orders that you want for natural dying. So how do we encourage people to have living wills? We are about to embark on a study entitled The Encourage Living Will Research Project, in which you can encourage your parents, your close friends, other loved ones to complete a living will. And one of the ways that we encourage it is to say, you know, if you're going to go to someone else and encourage them, maybe you need to know how to have that conversation. And that conversation, those list questions, are actually in the survey itself. And if people are interested in collaborating on this survey, I have to point out that as of mid-February, we have not yet submitted it to the Institutional Review Board. So we can do, we want to do a limited study, some pilots, and then go absolutely national and international, because I have colleagues in Britain and Australia as well. So our passion, our mission is to bring effective living wills to everyone who will be faced with the huge challenge of advanced dementia.
Well, Dr. Terman, you have really, you have really provided a lot of resources through Caring Advocates. I'm so impressed with this work you've done, because you not only have resources for professionals, you're doing research and publishing it, you've created books and these cards for lay people to use, and I am just really impressed with how comprehensive your work has been.
And I have to credit some of the most esteemed and well-recognized colleagues in this field. For example, perhaps the nation's primary authority on Catholic bioethics is Ronald Hamel at the Catholic Health Association in St. Louis, Missouri, the national leader in medical futility, being those treatments that are non-beneficial and maybe even harmful, and that is Thaddeus Mason Pope, who leads the health law division at Hamline University in Minnesota, and I can name a dozen more who have generously contributed their time, their energy, their expertise, their most detailed critique to make sure that the product is sound from each one of their standpoints. For example, Guy Miko, who was the head of the Center on Aging at the University of California, Berkeley. Ron Miller, who founded the Center on Medical Bioethics at University of California, Irvine, and so on. So we have people from the religious, from the legal, as well as from the clinical and bioethical, all of who have made tremendous contributions to create the best tools that we know are available today for not only advanced dementia, but for other terminal illnesses as well.
Well, Dr. Terman, this is such an important conversation for us to have, and such an interesting subject. And as you and I discussed before we started this call, there's so much more to cover than you could even possibly do in one interview. So it strikes me that maybe we need to consider having you back as a guest later on this year. And in the meantime, our listeners could submit their questions that they'd like to have you ask, so that we could get out the kind of information that those listening would most like to have and what might be of use to them. I hope that you'd be willing to come back a second time.
I would be delighted to know how your audience has heard what we've discussed, what they want to know further. And I'm just going to mention one topic that didn't come up, but it's really important. It's very devastating to receive the diagnosis of dementia. And you receive it when you're in the stage of early dementia, when you still have capacity to make decisions. 2 points. It is urgent to complete your living will and your ironclad strategy at that point in time, before you lose it forever, before that window of opportunity goes away. Second point, it's a very vulnerable time for patients, some of whom have what we call the dementia fear. They fear this: if I don't kill myself now when I can, then I won't be able to kill myself later. So that many people will commit suicide in the early stage of dementia only because they do not know about the ironclad strategy. And that is a tragedy. It offends the sanctity of life. It's unnecessary. It's horribly sad. And so we need to get the word out to those people. Do you know that the Huntington's disease, 30% of patients with that diagnosis attempt suicide, and it is one of the most common ways they die, with about 1 out of 16 dying from suicide. They don't have to. They can set up an ironclad strategy so that when they reach their selection of symptoms, according to the My Way cards or Natural Dying Living Will cards, then they can die naturally. So I'd love to talk to you more about that.
That's just a great point to make, and one that I'm sure hadn't occurred to me before. It's sort of the collateral risk of increased suicide deaths because of the diagnosis itself, when people don't feel there's any hope out there for them and don't feel that they will have any control over the final years of their life. And so that's an excellent point for you to make. I'd like to tell our listeners for right now that they can go to caringadvocates.org. It sounds like to get all of this information we've been talking about, your books, the cards, and even you mentioned the kits, thirst-reducing aid kits available through the website as well.
Absolutely. And they can also reach me at 800-64-PEACE. That's the P-E-A-C-E kind of peace. 800-64-PEACE is our toll-free phone number. And of course, as I mentioned, I'm available on Skype as well. And all the contact information is on the website. And we're here because we want to respond. So we would love to hear from you.
Well, I just want to thank you once again, Dr. Terman, for taking time out just to share all this information with us. And I'm looking forward to having you back again in the future. And I do want to encourage all of our listeners to go to caringadvocates.org and check out all of the fantastic resources there. But also, please submit any questions you might have for Dr. Terman to me by replying to the email, one of the emails you received from me. That's probably the easiest way to get questions back to me. Or you can go on the Facebook page for End of Life University, too. But I'll gather those questions before Dr. Terman's next visit here, and in order to get into the issues that you listeners would like to hear more about. So one last time, Dr. Stanley Terman of caringadvocates.org, thank you. Thank you once again for being with me today.
It's my pleasure, and I'm so glad that you asked the right questions and gave me the opportunity to explain what our mission is so that we can help more people face the huge challenge of advanced dementia and other terminal illnesses.
And we've been discussing the topic of natural dying. This is the End of Life University Seminar Series. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt. Please join us again in another 2 weeks for the next interview in our series, and encourage your friends and colleagues to sign up for this series as well. And until we speak again the next time, take care.